G'day and welcome to the Queensland Country Hour. I'm broadcasting today from the headquarters of the Queensland Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation. Upstairs from where I'm standing, there's a world-class laboratory and a team of researchers who are working on the next generation of the food we grow and eat. Competing in an ever-increasingly competitive global environment, though, Aussie producers need to be able to extract the best possible premiums for their product. For some, that might mean challenging the way they view our place in the world's commodity markets. If you're a producer of food or you're like me and just love eating it, stay with me as we delve into the future of food production in Australia to see what it looks like, how it'll be achieved, and if we're lucky, even what it tastes like. I'm Charlie McKillop and this is the Queensland Country Hour, broadcasting from the Queensland Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation, also known as QAFI for short, which is a very apt acronym because when I look to my side, there is a buffet of tantalising Australian regional produce. And we will be quaffing some of those distinctive regional flavours in a little moment. They form the basis of some of Australia's biggest branding successes. Think cheese, think wine, seafood. That's what's sitting before me right now, and you will be able to jump onto the Queensland Country Hour Facebook page to take a sneak preview of my lunch. But before we tuck into that, you're going to also meet some of the people who are charged with the task of keeping Australian agriculture ahead of the pack. But don't we already grow the best and the cleanest and the healthiest food in the world, I hear you ask? Well, yes, we do. But that might not be enough, particularly as our producers compete in an ever-increasingly competitive international market. Professor Robert Henry is the director of QAFI. Professor Henry, last time we caught up, you were standing knee-deep in your waders in the Mareeba wetland looking for wild rice varieties, but today you're dressed for business. You are the head of this department. Why is it that being clean and green is no longer enough for Australian agriculture?
Well, welcome to QAFI, Charlie, and it is good to see you Cape York swamps. Indeed, agriculture in Queensland and Australia faces a future in which it needs to continue to improve its competitiveness to ensure that it's a profitable and successful industry for all those involved. The world is a competitive place and we need to continue to improve the quality and efficiency of production of our agricultural products through the whole value chain, from the farm right through to the plate. There's room for improvements of quality, improvements of production efficiency, and we really need to work hard really to stay where we are in the world's competitive marketplace. So research and development that we deliver really is a key, I believe, to ensuring we stay in business in agriculture.
When we talk about finding niches in agriculture, that can often mean different things to different people. Where do you fit into that and what are some of those opportunities for Australian producers?
Yes, well, I think my sense of it is that Australian agriculture and food products need to be a very high value and fit into a high value niche, but that doesn't mean we're not producing large quantities of them. The example I would give would be wheat, where we produce 20 million tonnes of wheat, but my sense is that could be thought of as a niche product in the world because the world produces 600 or 700 million tonnes of wheat. And we need to have Australian wheat thought of as being a special product that has particular attributes that mean the market will pay us more for that wheat because it is a superior product.
So it's a bulk product in the world, but a niche for us in Australia?
Yes, I think so, because Australian production in most commodities is not by any means the bulk of world production. So our production is a small part of the world and we need to ensure that it's placed into the highest value market that we can relative to the product from other countries.
So, Professor Robert Henry, now that you have the attention of every bulk commodity grower in Queensland, tell us what is involved. Are there some practical examples that you could point to in terms of your research that might help producers extract that premium that they so often want?
Well, one good example is the one I've just spoken about in wheat. We've just recently identified a gene that determines the quality of wheat and how much flour we get when we mill it. So here's an example where we're potentially going to be able to produce wheat that delivers to the flour miller much more flour for each tonne of wheat that they buy. That should mean that they're prepared to pay a significant premium for that wheat, and it's something we could potentially envisage all of our wheat having. so we could potentially get a premium for our whole wheat crop. So that's niche marketing on a large scale.
And that's a tangible benefit. You're talking about a 10% increase in productivity because of its milling capacity.
Yes, there's a substantial potential to increase the overall value of the wheat crop with this sorts of technology.
What other commodities can you talk about? We've heard recently about high folate strawberries, for example, which are being grown and developed here in Australia. What's the potential there?
Well, I think in the horticulture industries, there's real potential for us to position all of our products again and differentiate them in the market such that they do have recognised advantages in terms of their quality, in terms of both consumer perceptions of the quality, the taste and the flavour, but also the consumer's perception of the health benefits of our product relative to products from elsewhere in the world.
And Professor Henry, when I was attending the University of Queensland, this building, the Biosciences Precinct, didn't even exist. What's the future for research in this food and agriculture innovation space?
I think the future is very bright because we've got many new technologies that will find application in agriculture. The advances in information technology and biotechnology and nanotechnology all provide great opportunities for us to accelerate our advancement of agriculture as a high-tech business where we can reap the benefits of this technology in our traditional agricultural industries.
And we are in the middle of a state election campaign. Well, not the middle, day three. You're going to be working both sides of the political spectrum to see whether you might be able to extract some commitments on the R&D front?
Well, I think agricultural research is something that everyone supports across the board, and we'd expect that would be the continuation. We've got we've long had good support in Queensland and nationally for agricultural research, and we need to see that continue.
Righto. Professor Henry, thank you very much for having us at the Queensland Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation. To my left is Professor Mike Gidley. Mike, what does Brand Australia mean?
So Brand Australia is something that people around the world look out for. There's been many surveys where people are asked, which part of the world would you like your food to come from? And Australia is right at the top of the list there. So Brand Australia has served our producers really well and has given them the starting point, the base, if you like, for getting into new markets and for making sure that the existing markets stick with us.
But it's the start, not the end game.
Indeed, yes. So we also talk a lot about our clean and green food supply. Whilst that is the case, we should not rest on our laurels, that there are other countries in our region who strive for the same cleanliness and greenness that we can offer. And we should imagine that will be successful. And so in the future, we should not imagine that clean and green alone is going to be enough to differentiate us in the minds of our consumers.
So looking forward, what are the niches and how do we target them?
So niches don't mean small amounts. As Professor Henry was saying, a niche in a world market is a huge volume. So we need to, first of all, understand that a niche is not just a tiny, tiny amount of material. Secondly, we have a unique advantage in that we are growing our food in a country that people want their food to come from. The one thing you cannot copy is where the food is grown. So if we can find ways that we can show people the value of something that's grown from Australia and from nowhere else, that is completely uncopyable. So our challenge is to say, well, okay, what is it about food from Australia that we can make distinctive? So we'll use the word distinctive. How do we make our food distinctive on the world market such that people are interested in it and it's seen as a premium product and that therefore people pay for it?
You're hearing from Professor Mike Gidley, who is the Director of Food and Nutrition Sciences here at QAFI, based at the University of Queensland. We are going to touch on some of that distinctive regional produce that is the basis of some iconic brands that have really succeeded in that space that you're talking about. But part of your brief is also about the nutritional value of fruit and vegetables. Isn't it just a given that fruit and veggies are good?
It is, and I think we need to be aware of the consensus that there is around the world. We understand now that a good diet for almost any people in the world is about balance and variety, but a lot of the way in which we can manage that is making sure we get enough whole plant foods. So we work on whole grains, vegetables and fruits. And really the new story in this area is the role that the microbes inside us play, and we're learning a lot more about the positive health benefits that we get from the microbes that live in our digestive tract.
So how can we make that food, those fruit and vegetables, even more nutritional?
So it's mostly about variety. So if we eat the whole foods, not juices, so if we eat whole foods, then we get the fiber from those foods, and that fiber is what feeds our microbes. They feed on that. We cannot break the fiber down, but our microbes can. So it provides the energy for our microbes, and then all of the wonderful chemicals that go with it, we talked about folate earlier and many other chemicals that come from plants, then they also nourish that those bacteria, and that allows the bacteria to give us a healthy start. An important thing to think about is that bacteria grow really quickly. So a bacterium can grow and divide on a timescale of hours. Our cells, our human cells, take weeks. So our bacteria can respond to our environment really quickly. And so when things are changing for us, our bacteria are early warning signals, and that they give us the responses that we need to function as a whole organism. So we are a vessel for our microbes.
So we hear so much about good fats, bad fats, too much sugar, cut your carbs. There's so much information out in the public domain for consumers. Should farmers be wary of chasing food trends?
Yes, they should, because the reality that, as is agreed really around the world in terms of health advice, is that a balanced and varied diet rich in whole foods is really all you need to know. So obviously there's a limit to how much energy you should take in, but if you're eating whole foods, there's a natural limit our bodies can take. And so be aware of the fads. They're just a gimmick to really try and get to a quick buck, but stick with the balance and variety and the healthy whole foods that we know are good for us.
Some good advice there for farmers and for consumers. Professor Mike Gidley, who is the Director of Food and Nutritional Sciences, thanks very much for being part of our conversation today.
You're very welcome.
We are broadcasting the Queensland Country Hour at 17 minutes past 12 at the Queensland Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation. Professor Gidley was talking about a wide and varied range of food groups, and sitting on my left is a platter of certainly wide and varied, although I'm not sure that the fibre content here is going to meet all the benchmarks that Professor Gidley was talking to me about. Heather Smythe, you, when it comes to food branding, this really epitomises why Australia is able to compete on the global stage. Can you explain why you've selected these particular foods for us, apart from my palate?
Oh, absolutely. Look, I've definitely focused on the delicious for you today, Charlie. I've chosen foods from across Australia, which are really iconic products that particular companies or particular businesses across Australia have developed and have achieved great success from by branding their product as regional and identifying the fact that products grown in a particular environment with a particular soil type or a particular feed source can have particular sensory qualities that are unique and distinctive and that are really desirable for consumers. So what I've got for you here, I've got some lovely wine, some lovely Clare Valley Riesling wine, which I think definitely epitomises a champion in the industry. Everyone knows a Riesling from the Clare Valley, and this is from a particular region within the Clare Valley called Watervale region, which is well known for giving very minerally beautiful, clean finishes to Riesling wines that are grown in that region. And would you like to taste some?
Well, I don't know why you started with the wine, because that's going to get me into all sorts of trouble with my producer, who's sitting at the studio listening intently. What I would like to ask you, though, is you've touched on that issue of distinctive regionalism, but does a region that is synonymous with beautiful Riesling wines lend itself to other food brands? Could you just as easily brand a cheese or an oyster from the same region?
Well, some people do. Consumers definitely see there as being an association between another product being grown in that region. Here we've got an Adelaide Hills Camembert, which is grown obviously by cows and from milk.
Have we indeed?
Yes, we do. And definitely these other companies that are taking advantage of those, that consumers identify those regions as being high quality, and that's a great thing. It doesn't necessarily mean that those other products are also to the same quality as perhaps the wine is from that region, but certainly that association is powerful.
What about seafood? You've selected some beautiful Coffin Bay oysters. Now tell me, how can you distinguish between oysters when they, you know, they all come from the ocean? Presumably it's Mother Nature's work.
Oh, I have a very special relationship with these Coffin Bay oysters, I'll be honest with you. A few years ago, I worked on a project identifying what was unique about seafood grown in the Eyre Peninsula region in South Australia. Everyone knows that Eyre Peninsula seafood is amazing, Coffin Bay oysters being one of those, but we don't necessarily understand the science behind what it is that makes it unique. So I had the very fortunate job of tasting a whole lot of oysters and a whole lot of other seafood products from that region and identifying what it was that made the sensory qualities of these products different from products grown or seafood grown in other areas. And I identified that seafood from that region is much more complex in its sensory diversity. So there's lots of flavours expressed at the same time. They're very intensely expressed, so they're very flavoursome. They're very tender, I guess texturally. They're very tender compared to products, seafood grown elsewhere. And interestingly, they all have a slight herbaceous note, a sort of a bottom note in the flavour, I guess, profile of these products, which isn't necessarily present elsewhere, like a freshness or something like that. And I'm told by the producers in that region that's a very unique type of algae that go in the waters from Antarctica that swirl up through that region, and that basically everything in the food chain is benefiting from eating this particular algae, and that might be an explanation as to why the seafood in that region is so fantastic.
Really? So could somebody who is, say, like myself, a lover of food but not necessarily a connoisseur, make these distinctions that you're talking about?
Well, consumers already are. They know that this particular product or that particular product is fantastic, and they go back for more. Obviously, they are speaking from their wallets, and they'll buy exactly what it is that they want. So the oyster, for instance, it definitely people know that Coffin Bay oysters are absolutely fantastic. We also have some prawns here from Queensland. These are Queensland farmed prawns, actually, and they're quite distinctive as well. They're really flavoursome. We've got, of course, Moreton Bay Bug, which is also from our region up here. So I've got you some gorgeous Queensland mango and Queensland strawberries. These blueberries are from Coffs Harbour. And all of these products from those particular regions, we know that if you buy it from that particular region, then you know it's going to be good. Consumers know that. But scientists like me, we need to come along and help explain what it is that makes it so great to help the producers in those regions be able to brand themselves with those characteristics.
Dr. Heather Smythe, you must have lucked it when you decided to specialise in this particular field. But what are the... when you are going out and you're tasting these products, what are the sensory qualities of Australian food that make it so distinctive?
Look, yeah, coming back to some of that stuff I found in Eyre Peninsula, I think that having powerful or strong sensory characteristics, lots of flavoursome, lots of great textures, lots of diversity as well. People want to have diversity in their diet. They want to not just be healthy, sorry, Mike, but they also want to be very happy and really enjoy their eating experiences and have lots of delicious things to eat, particularly in the healthy area. It's got to taste good or they're not going to eat it, are they? We expect our strawberries to be nice and flavoursome and sweet and juicy and delicious, and that's what we're looking for. And certain regions are great at producing the products that we want.
Well, I'm sure the proof is in the pudding, and I am just going to, as the consummate professional, continue to broadcast and just walk away from that beautiful selections of foods. Dr. Heather Smythe, thanks for being a part of our conversation here at the Queensland Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation. We will be meeting some more of the men and women who are basically charged with the task of keeping Australian agriculture ahead of the pack, and we will be coming back to that very soon. Right now, it's 24 past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
And if there's ever any doubt that the threats to Australia's clean, green reputation on the international stage are ever constant, you only have to reflect on the recent decision by China to ban a number of six, I think, meatworks from sending their products to China. Now, the good news is that that suspension was lifted yesterday on the six meat works. The abattoirs, which account for about 30% of Australia's beef exports to China, had been told that the bans related to Chinese concerns about non-compliant labelling. And the CEO of the Australian Meat Industry Council, Patrick Hutchinson, says that the labelling problems were a technical issue that have now been sorted out, but it did prove very costly.
Sort of conservative estimates of that of $1 million a day in lost opportunity income across those six establishments, basically around their inability to send to China and then having to move product elsewhere.
Why weren't import standards complied with in the first place?
As now Australia's largest manufacturing industry, at any stage when you could be putting together, I suppose, a chain of 32 cartons a minute, 30 cartons a minute or even more, at any stage there's going to be complications that arise from mistakes that could be made on labelling, issues of misinterpretation of our labelling programs. So what was happening there was China was seeing those mistakes and they were raising that as issues and they implemented those temporary suspensions in order for them to get the confidence in the system that they required. That's what the last 3 months has been about.
And at $1 million a day for 3 months, it's an expensive problem, but it does go to show you how seriously our export partners take food security.
Absolutely. And that's in fact how we have seen that. What puts Australia above the rest of the world is in fact our ability to be able to react to those things. 3 months, as I've said recently, is an expedient time to get back into a market from an establishment basis. Let's not forget that this wasn't a overall industry ban. This was temporary suspensions applied to six establishments. Those establishments provided a lot of product to China. However, what it showed was that our systems are in fact have the ability to be able to respond and improve, as opposed to others around the world that are also supplying China, where we hear anecdotally countries that have taken a year to 2 years to come back.
Several processes were affected, quite a few in Queensland, Casino in New South Wales and also Murray Bridge in South Australia. How do those big processes cope when all of a sudden they've got to stop processing their cattle?
What those companies were able to achieve was movement of product into other markets. As we are 70% export for beef, they were able to work together with their own importers as well as through their own internal systems in order to be able to supply other markets with that product, the initial product on the water, and then secondly be able to move product into other markets as well as provide the necessary confidences back to China that the issues that have been raised have been addressed and interventions have been put in place ensure that the requirements for China were being met.
Those companies, though, would have had to reduce their kill rates at some point.
Look, I don't think, as far as I'm aware, that kill rates had not been reduced in any way. It's just the fact that a more lucrative market such as China was not been able to access by those companies, and they have been able to move product elsewhere as well as retain inventory. Because, as I said, this was not a ban. This was with temporary suspension on their ability to raise input permits. It didn't restrict them from actually producing product and putting it into inventory.
Now, I understand you're about to walk into a meeting with the Federal Agriculture Department. What will be on the agenda?
Basically, the agenda will be purely and simply just the next steps, what we need to do to turn the systems back on to be sending product from those establishments to China. I think that's purely and simply what it's about. So it's never a case of just flicking a switch and then just sending the product back over there. We need to be making sure that we're very clear about that we've met all the requirements.
So we're talking maybe a couple of weeks to get these import permits sorted?
Oh, look, I don't think it'll take that much. But as I said, we just want to be making sure that we've got all our I's dotted and T's crossed.
That is the CEO of Australian Meat Industry Council, Patrick Hutchinson, with Lisa Herbert there. You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour, which is broadcasting live from the Queensland Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation. And we're certainly seeing that to great effect. We've become very popular in the last 10 minutes since Heather Smythe rolled out her regional food platter. They're like bees to the honey pot here at the Quaffy headquarters. Look, today's broadcast has meant that we've been a bit of a politics-free zone, but if you are keen to get back amongst the campaign trail, keep listening this afternoon on your Regional Drive program with Loretta Ryan after five today. She will have LNP leader Tim Nicholl with her, and she's going to be taking your calls as well on 1300 360 222. That's the number to call, 1300 360 222. If you have a question for the Leader of the Opposition, if you don't usually receive Loretta's program, you can stream it live via the ABC Listen app, which is also how you can listen to the Queensland Country Hour, by the way, if you can't get to a radio during the day. It's 12:30 and time to see what's making news. Good afternoon to you, Lisa Herbert.
Good afternoon, Charlie. And making news this afternoon, LNP leader Tim Nicholl says budget constraints are affecting his ability to campaign in the regions in the state election. Mr Nicholl has stayed in the southeast for the first 3 days of the campaign, while Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk went straight to North Queensland, where she announced the election on Sunday. Air charter costs and the availability of planes are a problem that both sides have to deal with in an election that will be heavily influenced by regional issues. The founder of Rams Home Loans, John Kinghorn, has appeared in a Sydney court charged with avoiding $30 million in taxes. Mr Kinghorn has not entered a plea. The 76-year-old is charged with allegedly avoiding taxes worth more than $30 million and not revealing to the Commissioner of Taxation that he controlled two companies between 2004 and 2007. Woolworths has revealed a surge in sales, marking its fifth straight quarter of food sales growth. The result is far better than Coles' state growth for the same period, which came in at a third of 1%. And trainer Chris Waller says champion racehorse Winx is a 50-50 chance of racing again in the spring carnival. The mare won her third consecutive Cox Plate on Saturday and has recovered well. Waller says he'll make a decision later in the week as to whether Winx will run in the Emirates Stakes. Charlie, more news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks so much, Lisa. And let's cross now to the Weather Bureau, where Rick Threlfall is keeping an eye on the radar for us. Not as active as it has been at this time most days, Rick, but still some storms around in the east.
Yeah, that's right, Charlie. Obviously, yesterday and the last few days have been pretty active storm-wise. We saw quite a number of severe thunderstorms around yesterday, producing significant wind gusts through Rockhampton, Thangool, Montau. Gatton picked up some gusty winds and reports of hail around a few parts of the state yesterday, even on the Atherton Tablelands and up near Mount Isa as well. But much quieter today. We've had a trough system moving through a mass of the state and clearing off the southeast coast overnight last night. That's introduced much drier, cooler air to a large part of the state, certainly all the way through the west of the state and across the south of the state. Much cooler, drier air there with fine and sunny conditions expected for many western and southern areas of the state over the next few days. But the surface trough has stalled today, lying from around about Normanton down to the Rockhampton area, and we still have some very moist, unstable air through to the northeast of that line, so through the northern central highlands and certainly all the way through the east coast, all the way up to Townsville, up to Cairns, still holding on to that moist, unstable air mass. So as we go through this afternoon, we're already starting to see one or two showers and storms popping up, most likely on the higher ground, sort of inland from Mackay up towards the Harvey Range, sort of west of Townsville and up into the Atherton Tablelands is the most likely area to see the showers and storms develop through today. And with a little bit of wind in the upper atmosphere, we might just see those making their way to the coast later on this afternoon, but a much less of a chance really. So Mackay, Bowen, Townsville, all the way up to Cairns, right on the coast itself, only a slim chance of those showers and storms making their way east to the coast later on today, but the vast majority of the showers and storms will stay a little bit further inland. And really not looking at too much chance of severe storms through today, like the last few days. May just pick up the odd localised bit of heavier rainfall if you do get a thunderstorm through this afternoon. But a lot of the state, certainly through the interior, should be fine and sunny through today, and a little bit cooler than it has been, certainly over the southern interior of the state. So quite cool, sort of 27 for Charleville, 28 for Birdsville, and Toowoomba 24, but still warm across the north of the state. Certainly through the Gulf Country, some parts getting up close to 40 degrees, Burketown getting up to 40 today, and still warm and humid all the way up, say, Townsville up to Cairns, getting up to 32 in Townsville today, and 31 or 32 in Cairns as well. And not a lot really changes tomorrow. That trough line's pretty slow moving. So again, northeast of a line from around Cowanyama to around Rockhampton, they're the areas most likely to see some showers and storms developing through the afternoon. Again, most likely over the higher ground. But away from that area, certainly all through the western districts and all the way across the south of the state, fine and sunny again tomorrow. And in fact, the same into Thursday. Again, it's most likely that sort of northeastern quarter of the state the more likely to see some showers and storms into Thursday as well, but the rest of the state remaining fine and mostly sunny and a touch cooler than it should be at this time of the year.
Just finally, Rick Threlfield, how are the coastal waters forecast looking?
Yeah, we've had that trough system moving through the Capricornia waters. So south of Gladstone at the moment, we've got east to southeasterly winds 15 to 20 knots, but elsewhere along the east coast, generally southeast to northeasterly winds about 10 to 15 knots. And a fairly similar story again tomorrow, most of the east coast generally seeing southeast to northeasterly winds around about 10 to 15 knots through tomorrow as well.
Not too bad for the boaties. Thank you very much, Rick Threlfield.
Cheers. Thanks, Charlie.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Did you have Weet-Bix for breakfast this morning? Because if you did, you may have noticed, or maybe you didn't, that one of the key ingredients that goes into that popular breakfast cereal is sorghum. Sorghum being another extremely important cereal crop for Australia and for many livestock producers as well. It's been regarded as a very useful source of feed for animals. But increasingly, its nutritional benefits are being recognised in human health as well. Dr. Glenn Fox knows quite a bit about this subject. How good is sorghum for us, Dr. Fox?
Good to see you, Charlie, again. I think sorghum would easily rate with a number of the health foods or health grains that we see advertised in the media quite a lot. It probably didn't get the publicity it has deserved over many decades because it is really seen as traditionally as an animal feed. But Australia is probably one of the few countries that doesn't see sorghum as a human food, whereas most countries that grow sorghum see it as a traditional and staple food. So we've been following that trend, looking at the nutritional profile of sorghum and specifically working with one particular flour mill, trying to understand the value we can add to that, specifically the bran product, so sorghum bran, and it would easily fit into some health or nutritional category, similar to wheat bran, rice bran and oat bran.
So this is why some breakfast cereal companies are tapping into that gluten-free status and offering it as an alternative to their mainstream products?
Certainly, the sorghum fits into that gluten-free status, so it has a special market in that context anyway. But the nutritional profile we've found in some of the sorghum was certainly rated in terms of very nutritious, easily into a healthy type product going into your Weet-Bix. There are commercial products that have gluten-free wheat products. So it certainly fits within that sort of new niche product market that Mike was talking about before.
What's the potential here for growers?
I think the opportunities for growers to continue to be savvy business people and look for markets before they start to harvest. Consider the quality of the grain they're going to take off. And the easy option might be to sell it down at the feedlot 10Ks down the road. But certainly there are a lot of food industries and even the export market into China for one of those particular products. There's plenty of scope for them to explore those markets.
For many, it is, I guess, hard to shake that perception of sorghum being a stock feed and a source of fuel. How big do you see this becoming?
I think it'll be a slow growth. And as people become more health aware and conscious that they want to eat more healthy food, there will be more and more demand for this. But I think it's more of a demographic distribution. Probably people towards our age, Charlie, are more health conscious than people with young families, even though they probably try to be health conscious. It's challenging to feed high fibre food to kids. So there's probably a demographic distribution on these foods that we'll be looking for. But certainly there's a growth market in health foods for people as they get into middle age and beyond.
Righto. Well, let's hear from Ronald Plant now, because he's an Australian miller that has taken on a pretty ambitious project of transforming this ancient grains image and turning it into a health food, as we've been talking about. And he's telling our reporter here that sorghum is not only delicious and gluten-free, it has enormous potential for his business.
It's an ancient grain, it's a super grain, and cooked the right way, as I'm just talking about the grain itself, not the flour. The flour goes in the gluten-free products, but the grain itself is a ready-to-eat grain.
You did mention that one of the good features of it is that it does very well at absorbing flavours. Is that a key?
It is, because it's a bland, neutral flavour by itself, and it will take up anything that you add with it, whatever flavour you want to add to it.
It's interesting how grains such as quinoa have become very popular for health-conscious people, and yet sorghum is also an ancient grain, and yet is it just not exotic enough, do you think?
People see it as a stock feed used for ethanol. People just don't see it as a food for human consumption.
The fact that it's so old, tell me a little bit about the history.
It's been around 8,000 years. It's been found in the tombs of the Egyptians. It's also in Ethiopia. It's a major crop in Ethiopia. Even to today, it's a major crop. And we supply in Australia the Ethiopian bakeries, more so Indira bakeries in Melbourne, with a red sorghum or white sorghum flour for their Indira breads, which is a traditional food for the Ethiopians.
And so the flour's already being used in, say, gluten-free breads. But in terms of promoting the pearled sorghum as a product in place of, say, rice, you're currently working on getting that into supermarkets. Can you tell me a bit about that product?
We're working on three lines of product. One is a salad line, one is a main meal line, and one is a breakfast cereal. It's got different flavours to suit the particular meal you're eating at the day.
For growers, if they're supplying your mill as opposed to, say, the ethanol plant at Dalby, is there a difference in terms of the product they need to provide?
Well, most of the we're concentrating on the white variety. That's the Liberty variety. It's the only one variety in Australia at the moment, but there are people working on engineering it. As I said, it's a GMO crop, and they're trying to improve the quality. I'd like to see a larger grain, more so than what's out there at the moment. But it all takes time, and it's until we start moving into the human consumption food, very little is going to be done about it. So we're in the early stage of getting it into the marketplace.
Are you finding there are enough growers interested in growing that white variety?
Well, you can pick and choose your growers. We have one particular grower grows our white sorghum at the moment. We're sitting on about 1,000 tonnes at the moment, but we also don't. It's not all going into the pearled or the whole grain. We do a lot of flours, gluten-free white sorghum flours, which goes into, as I said, into the gluten-free trade, into the breads, the cookies. It's going into pastas, making pastas out of it. So it's getting bigger and bigger, but it's a slow process.
Ronald Plant from Marilong Milling near Toowoomba there. And Dr. Fox, he's on a winner there. He thinks that he's been able to gain that premium that growers offer growers the premiums that they're looking for. Now, there's no sorghum on our tasting plate here, but you've been telling me during the break that it's not only good to eat, but also to drink.
Yes, Charlie, there's a long history of using sorghum in a number of different beverages. Traditionally in Africa, it was used for beer. Our Queensland listeners would be used to the typical beer we have in Queensland. In Africa, it's somewhat different and has a different taste, but often that was only due to the availability of the grain. So they've used sorghum in making fermented beverages for a very long time. The other market that's sort of growing in Queensland is this Chinese white liquor, white spirit market. And the last 4 years have been significant tonnages of sorghum exported to China to service this traditional liquor, which is very much a desirable taste.
An acquired desirable taste?
over time, I'm sure it would be.
Now, this is Baijiu, yes. And it's the largest selling liquor in the world.
It is, by a long way. It has lots of spirits and wines. It's a very traditional drink, and culturally it's used at a number of different ceremonies and festivals. The process is very different to a process we're used to in making any alcohol products that we consume. They actually bury the sorghum and other grains in the ground and let it ferment in the ground. They then remove that and distill off the alcohol. So there's seasonal effects, a bit like Heather was talking about. There's regional effects, there's seasonal effects, there's grain effects. Some are using 100% sorghum. Others are using sorghum mixed with rice and wheat. So depending on where you go, you'll certainly get a regional flavour of Baijiu.
Well, thank you, Dr. Glenn Fox from the Queensland Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation. Thanks for making sorghum sound sexier than I ever thought possible. And we really appreciate you being a part of the conversation.
Most welcome, Charlie. It's been good fun.
You are listening to the Queensland Country Hour, this lunch hour, and we've heard from a number of researchers who are working hard to ensure that Australian agriculture remains ahead of the pack. Now, livestock producers know a bit about competing on the world stage. Australia is the leading supplier of red meat to the world, and we eat more red meat than anyone else, according to a recent State of the Industry report. The beef industry last year, red meat industry last year, exported more than $15 billion worth of product. But my next guest, Steve Moore and Ben Hayes, are here to tell us that the real story is not about the volume of meat, but the quality that counts. Professor Moore, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Charlie. It's a pleasure.
Now, Ben Hayes, I'm going to start with you first. Can you tell me what makes beef taste so great?
Well, it's actually the fat in the beef that makes it taste so wonderful. I had the unfortunate experience of eating beef that had had the fat chemically stripped out of it, and I can tell you it was pretty miserable. So you really have to have some fat in the meat. That's where the really good flavour is.
That is music to my ears, Ben Hayes. Now tell me about your innovation and the role of genomic selection, your research specialty, in growing better tasting beef.
Right. So one of the key things we're aiming for there is to have reasonably high intramuscular fat. This is the marbling that you see in beef, again, for that great taste. Now, that's a hard trait, a hard thing to measure in a live animal, as you can imagine. So the technology we're working on is to peer into the DNA and to link that up to the amount of intramuscular fat or the amount of marbling that animals can actually produce, their genetic potential to produce this marbling. So that's the technology we're focusing on. If we can crack that, it'll be sensational because producers will be able to screen young bulls for these DNA markers and pick out the ones very accurately with a high degree of precision that are going to breed those steers and heifers that have really good quality beef, high marbling in their beef.
What other traits are instrumental to that?
Okay, so it's the more I work in the beef industry, the more it comes home to me how challenging it is for beef producers to get it exactly right, because they're aiming for these high-value markets, so high-value, high-quality beef, but at the same time, to be competitive with the rest of the world, places like Brazil, United States and so on, they have to keep their costs of production right down and they have to remain profitable. So they have to work on fertility of their cattle, for example. That's a really key driver of profitability. A cow has to have a calf year after year to be profitable in the herd. But again, this DNA marker technology, this genomics technology, we can aim it at fertility as well. And in fact, we've got very large projects going to link up the fertility of beef cattle to their DNA. So again, we can screen out those young bulls that have excellent genetics for fertility, and they're going to breed the cows of the future that are highly fertile in sometimes pretty challenging northern Australian conditions.
How big a sample are you talking about?
This particular project I'm talking about is 30,000 cows, so it's fairly large.
Any preliminary indication of the data that you're being able to collect through that?
We've got some data and we've got some tail hairs from the cows, which is where we get the DNA from. So the two essential bits are in the can. We just have to put them together.
Righto. And if you crack it, as you alluded to earlier, how far away are we from breeding the perfect cow?
So breeding is a process that takes generations. In cow years, cow generation is about 4 years, so it does take some time. But this technology is really going to let producers pick up the pace, because they can identify those bulls with the good genetics so much more accurately than in the past, and get the right balance between good meat quality, good fertility, good growth, and so on.
Thanks, Ben Hayes. Also, I'm speaking here today with your director of the Animal Sciences unit within QAFI, Steve Moore. And Steve, you, like Ben, very focused on how to create better tasting beef. And I'm sure that there are many producers that are listening intently to your quest to do that. But how does that translate on the international stage, where so much of our beef is heading into essentially a bulk commodity market?
Yes, I think that's the challenge. We have traditionally, over many years, sold into that commodity market. We have a lot of competition now from Brazil, from India, from other places. And we need to lift our game, which is not an easy thing to do, into the quality part of the market rather than the commodity part. That's the big challenge in Northern Australia, because we have a different subspecies of cattle in Northern Australia. We have the Brahmins, and they are slower growing, they are a little less fertile, and we have to address those challenges while lifting the quality of the product at the same time.
Domestically, we've seen an increase in the profile of beef branding. We have seen this on our television screens just recently, that the grass-fed versus the grain-fed beef brands. What does that mean for producers?
I think they have to make a decision. Any producer has to make a decision of where they're going to target their product. This is difficult in the industry because it's somewhat segmented in the various levels. You know, some cattle producers sell their animals on to a middleman, which sells on to the packing plant or the abattoir. So there has to be a decision made about whether you're going to own the animals all the way through, which market you're going to target, and where you can see a profit being made. That's going to be determined a lot by where you are in the country, because as you move further north, the conditions get harsher and it becomes more and more difficult to target your product.
But from what Ben Hayes has been saying, it doesn't preclude you from being in that space of trying to find a niche in your market.
Certainly not. And one of the issues is that there's a idea that Bos Indicus cattle, the Brahmins, produce lower meat quality. Well, sometimes, but we do have examples of very good meat quality coming out of those animals. So we've got to try and change not only the reality, but the perception of what that product is and how good it can be.
Steve Moore is the Director of Animal Sciences at QAFI, the Queensland Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation. And Professor Moore, how does the work that you've been doing in beef genomics and all around meat quality fit within the Meat Standards Australia framework, which is, of course, the industry's own benchmark for quality?
Yes, and that was a watershed in the industry when that came in. It really does give us an advantage over many of our competitors that we have that, but the work's not finished on that. As I said, there's a penalty you pay for having a Brahmin animal go through the abattoir in terms of MSA. Well, we want to break that nexus and make sure that if you are producing quality meat out of a Brahmin animal, that you don't get penalised because it's a Brahmin animal, for example. We want to be able to lift the fertility, so increase the productivity, so that those dollars go directly into the farmer's pocket. They don't have to rely on this segmented market. That's where the profit is for them. So all these things have to come together, and it's not only genetics, it's nutrition, it's health, it's welfare, all these things that impact the profitability of the farm and the quality of the product.
And when you spend all of your day immersed in these concepts and genomic selection and gene editing, are you a grain-fed man or a grass-fed man?
Having lived in North America for some years, I really think the Australian beef tastes better.
Irrespective? And what about you, Ben Hayes? Can I draw you on this controversial topic?
Oh, definitely grass-fed.
Wonderful. Gentlemen, thank you very much for rounding out our discussion about the role of beef genomics in producing better tasting, better quality Australian beef. And, well, now we're going to head to the cattle sale yards, find out what cattlemen and women are being paid for their cows today. Let's cross first to Meat and Livestock Australia's Jen Peart.
Good afternoon, Charlie. Most contributors made no change to their grids. However, there was a little movement in Queensland over the hook indicators this week. Yearlings and grown steers gained 1 cent and cows lifted 6 cents a kilo carcass weight. Across the state, yearling steers between 240 and 260 kilos averaged 476, while heavy yearling steers above 300 kilos averaged 490. And heavy MSA yearling steers averaged 509. Heavy MSA 70-day grain-fed yearling steers averaged 512, while MSA 100-day grain-fed lines over 300 kilos averaged 506. Medium-weight grand steers Norton Fourtooth averaged 474, while heavy grand steers Norton Fourtooth averaged 486. The top of the heavy cow indicator finished at 434 this week, while good condition cows from 240 to 260 kilos averaged 419 cents a kilo carcass weight. This has been Jen Peart for Meat and Livestock Australia.
Numbers were up at the Roma store sale today. Sonia Hornery has the quotes for us.
Good afternoon, Charlie. There was a yarding of 5,636 head today at Roma store sale, up 3,360 on last week. All buyers were present and operating in a robust market, and the class of cattle was above average to recent sales with a lift of 10 to 15 cents in places relative to quality. The widespread rain has freshened stock noticeably and morale is positive. An impressive line of 415 head from a Tambo vendor was sold onto feed at an average weight of 420 kilos for 312.2 cents a kilo. Yearling steers topped at 420 to average 360. Trade steers made at 368 to average 303. Yearling heifers made to 338 to average 311, and trade heifers made to 330 to average 284. Quality grand steers made to 288 to average 276, and young bulls sold to 326 to average 295 cents a kilo. No cows have been sold at the time of this report. This has been Sonia Hornery for the National Livestock Reporting Service.
And now let's head to Warwick Sale Yards, and numbers down there. Good afternoon to Doug Robson.
Good afternoon, Charlie. Numbers were down slightly for a yarding of 927 head. Yearlings were well supplied. There were several pens of grown steers and heifers and a smaller yarding of cows. Quality was fairly good in a stronger market. Restocker demand was very strong, with light restocker cattle selling 20 to 30 cents dearer. Weaner steers sold from 326 to 413 cents, calves up to 432. Restocker weaner heifers sold from 280 to 325. Medium weight feeder steers topped at 326 cents to average 303. Feeder heifers averaged 295 to be 8 dearer, while trade heifers ranged from 270 to 326 cents. Bullocks and steers weighed to 10 cents dearer, with some very good young steers through the sale. They sold from 285 to 304 cents, heifers up to 285, cows were 4 to 8 cents dearer, medium weights averaged 290. And 219, and heavy cows sold from 218 to 241 cents. Doug Robson at Warwick.
Good on you, Doug. And before we go today, a happy birthday to Australia's oldest family-owned feedlot. It is turning 60, and it's celebrating by doubling its capacity. I'm talking about Kerwee and the Stockyard Group, which is cutting the ribbon on its expanded facility. That's going to accommodate more than 20,000 head of cattle at the feedlot there. And it's certainly an achievement of which Stockyard CEO Lockie Hart is very proud of, being able to operate at such a high level in the industry over six decades. Just also looking at the commodity markets in New York, the March futures contract for number 11 sugar is 14.73 US cents a pound. That's up by a tenth of a cent. And December cotton is 68.89 US cents a pound, also up a quarter of a US cent. On the Chicago Board of Trade, December corn is sitting at 348.5, that's down one half, and up three quarters of a cent is December wheat at 435.5 US cents a bushel. Recapping that China has lifted suspensions that were placed on six Australian meatworks in July, those abattoirs which accounted for around 30% of Australia's beef exports to China, have now been told that the bans related to Chinese concerns about non-compliant labelling, and those issues have now been addressed. Don't forget, a little later on this afternoon, ABC Queensland on ABC Radio Queensland, opposition leader Tim Nicholls will be live in the studio taking your questions after five. You can call in on 1300 360 612. That's 1300 360 612. And for now, we're signing off from the Queensland Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation. Thanks so much for being a part of it, and I'll catch you again tomorrow.